Let's go.
You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
Welcome to Making Data Simple, everybody. Thanks for making your way back. I hope everybody's extremely well. I have been preparing for client visits. I've been performing client visits. As a result, the last couple of podcasts have been replays. I did one on ChatGPT, another on the author of Being Bold. I thought they were both very interesting, so I wanted to hit those again. The great news about having a podcast, particularly one that is going pretty well, thank you all for that, is that we can pick and choose the guests that we have. So speaking of, I have Vinca LaFleur today. Did I pronounce that right, by the way?
I pronounce my first name as if it rhymed with Senka, for those of you who remember Senka brandy caffeinated coffee. So I say Vinca LaFleur. All right. But Vinca, you're very close. Yep.
All right. I almost had it. Vinca LaFleur, managing partner of West Wing Writers. I met Vinca at a seminar in IBM where she told us what she had learned across a varied career on writing, communicating, took some great tips and tricks and some great stories along the way. And if I could give you a quick introduction and then I'll turn it over to you, Vinca. She's been a professional staff writer for the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. She's a speech writer for Secretary of State, U.S. Department of State, special assistant to the president. By the way, none of these are in sequential order. Some of these are happening at the same time. Special assistant to the president, National Security Council. She started her own company, Vinca LaFleur Communications. She's a founding member of Chief. Chief is a private network built to drive more women into positions of power and keep them there. And speaking from a family of three other women and myself, very talented women, and on the back of International Women's Day, that's awesome. And then she is a managing partner in West Wing Writers. Again, not sequential. Welcome, Vinca. Thank you for being here. Please start and don't leave anything out. Don't be modest. Tell us about your career, if you would, starting out, and what brings you to today.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you kind of covered the highlights there. I think I was actually, for most of, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a diplomat. That was what I aspired to be. And I did a lot of international exchanges when I was young. I went off to college. I majored in French. I studied abroad. I went to graduate school, got a master's degree in international affairs. And my whole plan was to become a diplomat. And right before I finished my master's degree, I took the Foreign Service exam. And in those days, the way they offered the Foreign Service exam was a little bit different than how they do it now, but it was only offered once a year, and there were two parts. There was a standardized test, kind of like an LSAT or an MCAT, and then there was what, if you passed that, you got invited to take what they called the oral exam. So I passed that standardized part, and then I got invited to take the oral, which I did, and then I wasn't going to hear about my results from the oral until the spring, really midsummer. And so I finished my master's degree. I was living in Washington, kind of waiting to get the results from the State Department about the Foreign Service exam. I had an unpaid internship at Foreign Policy Magazine. I was 24 years old. Finally, the letter came in the mail, and it was, 87, so the letter came in the mail. And and I opened up that thin envelope, and to my shock and dismay, I had failed the Foreign Service exam. And not only had I failed, but they had ranked me very high in what they called administrative ability. And as I say, I was 24 years old and had basically been in school my whole life. They had ranked me very low in two areas. One they called cross-cultural sensitivity, and the other was writing. And what I often say is, when I was 24, those were the only two things I was pretty sure I was good at. So it was really, it came as a huge shock. And I suddenly, I had to scramble and figure out what I was going to do next. And as fate would have it, the Foreign Service exam wasn't even going to be offered again the next year because there was a class action suit against it saying it discriminated against women, which in retrospect, I think maybe it did. In any event, what happened was I ended up getting a job on Capitol Hill, answering mail on foreign policy for a liberal senator from Illinois named Paul Simon. Some of your listeners may remember him. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee, a terrific guy. I did that for a year. Then I went, as you said, to the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, and I was a human rights analyst shortly after the Berlin Wall had come down. I did a lot of international election observing in Romania, Moldova, traveled a lot in that part of the world at a very exciting time in history. I was at the commission for 4 years, and during that time, Bill Clinton won his first term in government. And sort of halfway through his first term, I heard that the U.S. Secretary of State, who at the time was Warren Christopher, was looking for a speechwriter. And I applied for that job, and lo and behold, I got that job. So the chronology awesome. Is that 5 years after I failed the Foreign Service exam because I couldn't write, I got hired to be the speechwriter for the Secretary of State. And then the rest, you know, just all kind of fell into place. I spent a wonderful year at the State Department. Then I was recruited to go to the White House to be a speechwriter, a foreign policy speechwriter for Bill Clinton. My immediate boss was Tony Blinken, who is now our Secretary of State. Amazing wow. how all these things work out. And I spent 3 amazing years in the White House writing foreign policy speeches for President Clinton. Then, as you said, I went out on my own. I ran my own consultancy for about a decade. And then merged my practice with West Wing Writers in 2008. West Wing is a strategic communications firm that was founded in 2001 by 3 of my other former White House colleagues who had also been speechwriters for President Clinton. And the firm has grown from those original 3 guys to the team of, you know, close to 45 people that we are now, headquartered in Washington with a big presence in New York, presence in California. And since COVID, we've got writers everywhere now that we work in new and remote and hybrid ways. But it's a, you know, it's a profession, as I say, that I kind of fell into a bit accidentally, but one that has turned out to suit me really, really well. And while I started out as a foreign policy person who liked to write and then became a writer who was interested in foreign policy, I think my career has now evolved, you know, to be a writer who's interested in all kinds of things. And then increasingly also a trainer and now as managing partner also, I'd like to think a leader. And so I feel very fortunate to have had the career there.
Very nice. That's impressive. Aren't you glad you failed that test? I mean, it turned
out
to be.
I know, right? I love talking to students who are, you know, just finishing their own studies, because I do feel like my experience is instructive and just a reminder that sometimes what feels like the absolute worst thing in the moment turns out to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Because who, you know, it really, that founding failure, as I call it, my founding failure, ended up setting me on the path it was really meant to be.
Well, I'm going to have to give this to my daughter, because one of my daughters, she didn't get selected for audiology school, and she's like just out of her mind. But I told her, be thankful for unanswered prayers.
That's good things happen.
And she's already working in an audiologist clinic, and things are going extremely well. She may go back to school for it, but she's getting a bunch of training. She's learning different areas where she could go with audiology. So, I mean, it's all going to work out. But I got to believe that test was a little bit flawed. I mean, to my understanding, you were summa cum laude at Yale University. So something's amiss. I don't know how you don't pass. That doesn't make any sense to me.
We'll never know.
I got to ask you this. After all that career in or around politics, do you have more faith in politics now or less? Or it was just a job in there? I mean, I'm kind of curious as to your point of view there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, so I did spend the first 7 years of my life in public service, but I wouldn't call it politics. I would call it policy. You know, that's really, I had never worked on a campaign. I really came to it as a policy expert, or, you know, aspiring policy expert. And that was sort of my entry point into it. I mean, working in the Clinton administration for me was just the privilege of a lifetime. I believed very much in what that administration was trying to do. And, you know, for me personally, it certainly kind of made everything else possible. But also, I was just very proud of so much of what was being accomplished at that time. But it's hard not to just not to recognize that it was a different world. You know, I mean, we thought in those days, you know, that we were really struggling with what felt like a news cycle that wouldn't quit. And we were talking about CNN, you know, much less Twitter and Drudge Report and Citizen Journalists and, you know, iPhones and cameras and just all of the, you know, the relentless and fake news. And, you know, and now we got ChatGPT, you know, which you're talking about too, AI. And I mean, it just so much has changed, and the demands, it was in the Clinton administration. I think that was the first White House to have a website. I mean, that's what it was like back then. It was just a very different time. So the experience of being somebody who was kind of on the communication side, and, you know, just the experience of working in government at that time was different than I think it is now. And as fast paced and intense as it felt then, it is just even more so now. That's clear. Then about politics in general, I don't know. Well, maybe we should leave that for.
We'll leave that alone. I was just curious. That's an interesting story. Very, very interesting experience. Brings up a whole lot of fun questions. I'm going to ask a couple more, and then I want to get into your craft. You obviously got to hang out with Bill Clinton a little bit. And walk him through some of the speeches, I got to believe. Was that fun? I mean, was he good to hang out with? Did he take your writing well, or did he provide a lot of feedback and told you to go back to the lab and keep writing? I mean, how did that relationship go?
Yeah, it was both. I will say that, you know, one of the real joys of writing for somebody like Bill Clinton, I mean, I think even people who were not, you know, fans of Bill Clinton would acknowledge that he was a great public speaker. He was somebody who very extroverted, really drew attention from a crowd, very comfortable at a microphone, loved communicating with people, really, really saw the importance of it, invested in it, and cared about it, and was good at it. And a couple of the things that made him good at it. So one is just, you know, he's a great explainer, very good at taking complex ideas and breaking them down in ways that people found relatable and that they could understand and that meant something to them personally. And that was something I really learned through that experience. So very grateful for that. He also just, you know, somebody whose own interests were so wide ranging. You know, this is somebody who had been born in Hope, Arkansas, and, you know, gone off as a Rhodes mm-hmm. Scholar in Oxford and so many things, you know, along the way and beyond. And he had very, very wide ranging intellectual and interests. And so you could, as a writer, then, you know, and I would think about this when I was working on speeches for him, I could put references to history in a speech. I could put references to literature in a speech, poetry, scripture, but also pop culture. And all of it would be believable coming from him, because he was somebody who just, you know, was very contemporary, but was also somebody who was seen, you know, who was a scholar, who could speak all of those languages fluently, if you will, and credibly. And so as a writer, then that, you know, that gave you a lot to draw on when working with him. And he was a great editor. You know, brilliant writer in his own right. And, you know, it's just that, you know, the president has a big job and writing speeches takes a lot of time. So that's why somebody like a president or a CEO or others have, you know, have people on staff helping them with this work. It's very time consuming, but the best of them are very invested in their own work and make it their own. And he was an excellent editor. So was it, you know, you said hang out with him. I can't, you know, pretend that I was hanging out with him on the paper. But where I would see him most frequently was, you know, because I was a foreign policy speechwriter, it was when he was traveling abroad. And oftentimes, you know, traveling on Air Force One, those trips, especially the longer ones, those would be the moments when he was putting the final edits on the speech. And so on the plane, literally, you know, taking the draft up to the president and getting his edits, he always used a Sharpie pen, you know, getting them back, inputting the edits before we land, you know, sometimes even in the motorcade, the last minute. It was really just, the honor of a lifetime.
So then you make the edits. By the way, that was one of the questions I had as to how involved were they? It sounds like Bill was pretty involved. He would go through every speech and make sure he went through it and put his spin on it, I presume?
Certainly the, you know, the really big ones. Yes. I mean, we had a habit of calling everything a speech, because pretty much everything you had to have something written down, even if it was just, you know, talking points for a photo op that odds were he wasn't even going to use. He would just be doing that off the cuff, but you still had to have written it down just in case. And we kind of called everything a speech. He wouldn't, you know, be pen editing little things like that, but certainly, yes, you know, the big addresses, the keynotes, he did look at everything. He reviewed everything. And
did you ever get into it? Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, finish your
comment. No, not at all. No, I would not say that I personally ever got into it, but there were moments. There were moments for sure, you know, when he would send drafts back and say, I want more, I want different, this isn't right, you know, what about this? For sure. Yeah.
Had to be stressful. Yeah.
It was stressful. It was stressful, but it was exciting. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that makes it stressful, of course, is, you know, the president of the United States just occupies this really extraordinary role, because kind of every word that comes out of that person's mouth is going to be hyper scrutinized by everybody, not just here, mm-hmm. but everywhere. And, you know, kind of whatever that person says is kind of taken as U.S. policy. So it was sensitive, you know, and so the stakes always felt very high. But also, it was a thrill. And, you know, and a lot of what we were writing about, I mean, I think, again, this is one of the things that made President Clinton and other, you know, political leaders and public servants that I admire, that I think makes them so good, is that they never forget who it's all for and who it's all about, you know. And in writing for President Clinton, we were always reminding ourselves to be thinking about the person at the end of the policy. You know, you come in as a speechwriter at that moment when all of the, you know, the folks have been hard at work kind of crafting the policy, negotiating the policy, hammering out the, you know, the details of the policy. And then you get to come in at the moment that it's going to be presented to the public, to the press or to the public or to whomever. And that's, you know, a really exciting moment to come in. But it's also the moment then when, you know, the story here is not the details of, you know, how tough the negotiation is. Or was the story is the difference that it's going to make in somebody's life. And that was what we were always trying to, you know, to make sure that we understood and that we could share, is why does this matter? Why should you care, you know, as an audience? What is the significance of this? Why did we work so hard to make this possible and to humanize it? Which, you know, thinking then more broadly, just sort of my own philosophy about communications, I mean, I do think this is just one of the critical things, to always be thinking about your audience and what you're, you know, what you want to say is one thing, but you really have to be thinking about how are you going to make this meaningful to them? What's going to make this matter for them? And why should they want to listen to what you want to say?
Back to purpose. I always talk about three things that I've learned is autonomy, mastery, and purpose, something everybody wants. And that purpose thing, I got to believe, in terms of speech writing and seeing the president take your speech and influence and inspire others, that's got to be a trip. That's got to be something that really gets you going, I got to believe.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, some of, you know, moments you never forget, and very proud to have played, you know, played a small part of it.
That's awesome.
It's exciting to help someone find the words.
And you're the second person on this podcast that's been on Air Force One. That's pretty cool. It sounds like you flew on it all the time.
not all the time, but that was, you know, that was what he took to go overseas. And so when I was on those trips, yeah, I was on the plane.
I used to love Saturday Night Live. Now, they weren't always kind to him either, but they had one skit that was just fantastic where he'd put his thumb outside the curtain. And everybody would cheer. And he would come in and say, I am invincible. It was great. It was fantastic. Anyway, let's talk about your craft. And you mentioned this earlier. I don't know if it's harder today than it was back then, or is it just different? We have so many mediums. We got video. We got texting. You mentioned ChatGPT. It's all over right now. Sometimes I think we've lost some of the art in writing. Now, heck, we're having an AI computer write for us, and sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not even close. Where are we today with the craft? What's your view? And well, we'll stop there. Where are we with the craft?
Yeah. Well, so I couldn't say, you know, where we are sort of broadly, but I will tell you where I hope, what I hope we never lose. And what worries me a bit about, you know, some of the direction that I see things going now. I just very much believe that writing and thinking are inseparable, and that you can't have a good piece of writing without having clarified your own thoughts. And oftentimes it is in the act of writing that you do clarify your own thoughts. It is in the act of writing that you figure out what it is you really mean, how you really need to organize your thoughts to make the argument you want to make. When you see your own words on paper, you realize what does kind of cohere and what doesn't. And those two things are inseparable. And so even though I do very much value and you know, often argue for and advocate, you know, concision and clarity and so forth. I'm a fan of brevity. But that doesn't mean, and I'm a fan of, you know, simple language, but that does not mean dumbing it down. It does not mean robbing things of texture. It does not mean robbing things of detail and specificity. And then when we start talking about AI, you know, or the human experience. And so I believe that in order to write simply and clearly and concisely, you actually also have to know how to write, you know, more fully. I think that really good, sharp, clear writing can only come through lots of practice and reading as well as writing. And I was looking before we spoke, there's a quote that's sort of out there in the world attributed to all kinds of people, many of whom it did indeed say it. It's most often attributed to Woodrow Wilson, but he's not the first person to have said it. But the quote is basically, if I'm to speak for 10 minutes, I need a week for preparation. If 15 minutes, 3 days, if half an hour, 2 days, if an hour, I'm ready now. And this sort of idea that, yeah, you know, if you just want me to like, blah, blah, you know, just speak off the cuff and, you know, whatever's popping into my head, I'm ready to go. But if you want me to give you something really sharp and compelling and tight and good, I need a week to prepare. And that really resonates with me. That is my experience, you know, professionally with speech writing and with all the kinds of writing and editing that we do at my firm. So I don't want people to get confused, you know, the idea that, you know, because so much of our writing now is happening in shorter bursts or that people's attention is now, you know, we're so distractible and we have so many options. And so you have to really, you know, get people with 140 characters or whatever. That does not remove the need to be able to be, you know, a good, strong writer in the traditional sense. The way, you know, the people like me were taught kind of growing up with a pen and paper, you know, long before laptops and everything else. And even though, you know, technology has made my job so much easier and has made me a better writer. You know, it's much faster to work with all the tools that we have now. But I do not believe that the skills that make for good writing can be replaced, you know, by an app. I just don't. And I really hope we never lose that.
This is fascinating listening to you because I totally agree. I am interested in the tricks, and hopefully we get to that in a bit. But I don't know who said the quote, simple is hard, but simple is so hard. Mm-hmm. And I think we try to cheat the system a lot. And I think PowerPoint can be a good medium, but I can tell you, I see a lot of over PowerPoint in terms of cheating the system. Instead of doing complete sentences, you just put it in a bullet, but the bullet loses context and everything else like that. My team struggles with me. I'll give you a perfect example. We started out with, you know, some operational reviews, and we started out and it started with PowerPoint. Everybody had 10 minutes and they'd all go 20 minutes. And then my schedule was always off. I mean, it was a mess. So then what I ended up doing is I said, all right, we're going to try something here. You're going to give me a video and it's going to be no more than 5 minutes. And if it's more than 5 minutes, I'm not watching it. So it can't be more than 5 minutes. So tell me everything in 5 minutes. I need it just as well as they do, the practice to get important information in 5 minutes. And then I asked them for a one pager to document in complete sentences the operations that they were describing to give me more detail. Because I think I'm with you. When you have to put it in paper, you really find out whether you understand what you're saying.
That's right.
Because all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, I really don't understand that. I mean, I thought it was simple, and it's simple when you put it on that bullet. But once you start writing it out, it's like, oh, that doesn't sound right. I got to figure it out. Sounds like you're on that wavelength, but is PowerPoint, let's go to PowerPoint real quick. Is there a medium for that? Or would you say stay as away from PowerPoint as much as possible? What are your thoughts there?
I use PowerPoint, you know, for certain things. I do some training and workshops and things, and I always have PowerPoint presentations for those. But I think of PowerPoint as a tool to help me give my points more power. If the PowerPoint deck that I prepare could stand on its own and I didn't need to be there at all, then why should I be there at all? That's not a good PowerPoint deck, right? Like the PowerPoint deck is not just a written version of what I'm going to say. The PowerPoint should be enhancing what I'm going to say visually, so with illustrations, maybe, you know, highlighting something like calling out a sentence or a line, or, you know, putting something in big font so that it kind of gets imprinted in people's brains for people who are more visual learners than auditory learners. But what I am not a fan of is when people put so much text on a slide that you are encouraging your audience, as my mom, who's a professor, would say, to read instead of heed. You want them, you know, to be listening to you, to be looking at you and engaging with you and listening to you. And the slide in the backdrop should just be, again, kind of giving your message more power. And I also, you know, in my case, because I'm not a tech expert like you and your colleagues, you know, I never want to be in a situation where my show couldn't go on if my technology failed. So I never want the PowerPoint deck itself to be the main attraction. I need to be the main attraction in my script so that, you know, if the PowerPoint fails, that I can still do the job I'm there to do.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. One thing, the last time we talked, that you mentioned is your, I think it was 10, 20, 30 rule. Could you talk to that?
I could, although it's not mine. I have borrowed it shamelessly from Guy Kawasaki, but with full attribution. So Guy Kawasaki, who is a venture capitalist and entrepreneur and many other things. It's his rule as somebody who has heard many people come and pitch business ideas. And he says the best pitches from entrepreneurs follow this 10, 20, 30 rule. So no more than 10 slides, no more than 20 minutes long, and 30 point font. I think I've got the 10, 20, 30 right there. I'll double check myself. But yes, that's what it is. And so it's really, you know, again, keep it short, keep it tight. Don't rely on the slides. You know, you are the main attraction. The slides are illustrating what you're doing. And then the 30 point font prevents you from, you know, putting more words on the slide than the audience should really be trying to absorb.
I think that's the key, that 30 point font. Then there's only so much you can do at that point. And you've really got to tighten it up, which I think is great advice. Let's break down some of the speech writing and stuff that you've done. How do you start? What do you need up front before you begin? What's your process, if I could ask?
Yeah, I mean, I can use, you know, I'll use a real example to just sort of make it to illustrate it. So I can use an example from the White House, say. So I worked with President Clinton on a speech that he gave in Belfast. It was end of November, kind of beginning of December 1994. And it was the first time a sitting U.S. president had ever been to Belfast. It was a very exciting time in the peace process, a sort of a hopeful time where, you know, the troubles seemed like maybe they would be coming to an end. So this trip was a big deal, and he was going to be giving a speech at a plant. That was the location that had been chosen for his speech, a plant called Mackey's, which sadly no longer is in operation, but at the time it was. And this plant had been chosen in part because of its physical location. It actually kind of sat right on the peace line in Belfast, and workers from both the Protestant Catholic communities worked there. They would come in through separate doors, but meet on the factory floor. And as it happened, this factory made machinery that wove textiles. So the symbolism was also, you know, this idea of kind of weaving a fabric together. And it was a very rich kind of location to be thinking about from a writer's point of view. So I knew that the president, this was where he was going to go give his kind of big policy speech of the day. And we knew this in advance. So that process then begins with, okay, you know what the setting of the speech is, you know how long the speech is supposed to be, a keynote address, you know who's going to be in the audience, you know sort of why he's going, what the purpose of the trip is, and so forth. And for any speech, then again, these would be some of the details you want to, you know, of course, understand on the front end. What is the occasion? Why is the speaker giving this speech? Have they been invited? Is this something that happens every year? Is it just something for them? To really understand the setting, and then crucially to understand the audience. Because as I was saying before, you know, part of this is what you want to say, but what you want to say is irrelevant if the audience isn't going to absorb it, appreciate it, find it meaningful, and ideally then remember it and potentially even act on it if there's a call to action at the end. So to understand the audience, you do, I think of it as kind of two different levels of research. On the one hand, there's kind of basic demographic research you would do about an audience, you know, literally, who are they? Are they male? Are they female? Are they American, international? What is their level of expertise? How old are they? So forth, kind of basic demographics. And then the other part I would call an emotional screen, which is what's on their mind. What do they care about? What do they think about you? What do they think about the issues at hand? What are they worried about? What are they excited about? What are they proud of? What would they want you to know about them? You know, what are the ways then that you as a speaker can connect with them and honor them sort of where they are, you know, mm-hmm. indicate that you know where they are. So really understanding the audience as best you can is part of the front end research. And then, you know, the way that we work at West Wing Writers, so now to sort of step back from the White House just for a minute, the way that we work at West Wing Writers is if we are going to be writing a speech for a client, we have an interview with the client. So we've already done a lot of this kind of research on our own to really understand as best as we can kind of what the scenario is, but then to talk to the speaker, you know, what do they want to say? Why are they excited about this event? What are they thinking? Do they have themes in mind to try and draw from them what they want to get out of it and what they want to achieve with it? And to get from the speaker in those conversations, the kinds of stories and personal details and anecdotes or personal experiences that we wouldn't be able to find on our own. Because one of the other things that really makes writing of all kinds, but certainly a speech, memorable is when you can go from the generic to the specific, when you can say something that only you can say, or when you can describe something in a way that again, just sort of makes it clear that, you know, you really know what you're talking about. You've really experienced it. So whether, you know, that you know who your audience is, but also then whatever the issue is, that you really understand it in a granular way. And you do that with detail, by going beyond the generic to detail. And to make this concrete a little bit, you know, we think about jargon that creeps into all kinds of things, but like words like stakeholder, you know, we talk about stakeholders. Well, who are your stakeholders? Are your stakeholders, you know, if you're talking about healthcare, are your stakeholders medical professionals? Are they nurses? Are they patients? Are they families? Are they, you know, to break these things down beyond the generic to the very specific and then to localize it. Anyway, so you want to be doing a lot of research about the topic. You want to hear from the client or the speaker themselves what they want to say. And then you start to marry this together to come up with a structure. You have to think about a logical structure to make the argument that you want to make. Always, again, keeping in mind the audience. How can you fuse together the message that you are trying to get across with what is going to be meaningful to them? Why should they care? Why does it matter to them? To address any doubts they may have, to you know, encourage any excitement they may be feeling. And potentially, again, at the end, oftentimes there's a call to action and a speech. So you want to be clear on what that is and what are you going to send them away with. And maybe I'll stop there. But those are some of the elements that go into the process. It's really a lot of research. You know, if you do the research on the front end, at West Wing Writers, we sometimes say R&D for us means research and dialogue. If you get all the information on the front end, the writing is usually the easy part. And the hardest speeches to write are when actually you don't really know. You don't know what the speaker wants to say. You don't really know who you're talking to. Those are the ones that are hard. But when you've done that research on the front end, the writing is usually the fun part.
I think most people forget, you know, like anything, whether it's a sports or otherwise, they forget the practice in the relentless research that goes in behind the scenes before you see the final submission. How much research would you say you do for every line of text? I mean, how much time are you spending researching? Like if you go into Belfast, I got to believe, this is why I kind of said politics earlier, because I got to believe you've got to like research this, research that. You got to know what's going on in the region. You can't make a faux pas. You can't say something that you may inadvertently step into a mess that you didn't even know existed. So you've got to really spend a ton of time. Yeah. How much time would you say is spent doing that research?
So at West Wing Writers, if we are working on a keynote speech, which we would say, you know, is a speech that's maybe 20 minutes long, we would budget 40 hours, 40, to write
it. Wow.
Yeah. And then thinking about that Belfast speech, I'll just come back to it. And again, you know, this was 1994. So the tools that I had to do research were very different, you know.
Yes, yes.
I had never been to Belfast and I needed to get a sense in my mind of what it looked like. Now, the nice thing about working in the White House is, you know, you can call up folks in the State Department, and they'll take your call, and they'll, you know, we were getting good information from diplomats in the region who could give us good advice. But then also, you know, I cast a wide net. So as I say, my parents are both actually professors, retired, but my mom was teaching at Princeton at the time, and one of her colleagues at Princeton was from Ireland and a poet. And I reached out to him and I asked him for some advice about some Irish poets that I might quote and, you know, good lines that I could use. I went to the library in the White House and got on microfiche, back issues of the Washington Post travel section, and scrolled through those things to read about Northern Ireland and to look at pictures and to read, you know, articles literally on microfiche from the travel section about Northern Ireland to try to get a sense in my head of what the place looked like. And things that I could reference. I read stories, you know, a lot of research. I read books. I mean, I read books about the Troubles, but then more contemporary, I was reading the press, both the U.S. press, but then also the foreign press, about things that were happening in real time that we could weave in. And there were a lot of things happening in real time, because as I say, it was, you know, an exciting moment in the peace process. There had been a ceasefire. Things were happening. And if you look at the president's speeches from that trip, you know, you'll see references to things like there was a line that I had found from a newspaper article where somebody who lived there had sort of observed, even the normal is beginning to seem normal. And I loved that line, you know, that this was right. This sort of exciting kind of hopeful time for the people who lived there. And so, I mean, a lot of research of all different kinds to try to pull a speech like that together. And, you know, obviously I was not making policy about, you know, U.S. policy toward Northern Ireland or toward the United Kingdom or any of that. The policy was being made by other people, but my job as the speechwriter then was to help try and talk about it and frame it, again, in ways that would help the president really connect with the public that he was trying to reach.
Well, let me restate. You make sure you know your audience and have an emotional screen, could be a country. You interview the speaker, make sure you look at stories and anything that makes things personal. You take the generic to specific, then you outline your structure, fuse everything together, probably leave with a call to action. But like when you're doing the president, I got to believe you can't always interview your speaker, but you know he's got a very specific view on policy, I'm sure. Don't want to get that wrong. Who do you interview in that case?
Well, so I was a member of the National Security Council staff. And so there were, you know, the policy makers were my colleagues. So that was easier in some ways. But, you know, when I think about my work as I practice it now, so if we're writing, you know, for a leader of a company or a foundation or a nonprofit, you know, they have their policies too, and they have the people in their organizations. If you can't, you know, always be talking to the leader of the organization, you can be talking to the people in the organization who are empowered to share that information with you. So, you know, that kind of knowledge is on their end in a way, but again, that our job is to help them figure out how to present it, how to explain it, how to share it in a way that is going to reach the audiences they want to reach and motivate or mobilize the audiences in the ways that they're trying to do.
Do you think the structure also works for the corporate or business world? You think it's much the same?
Well, it depends on what the nature of the communication is. But yes, I mean, I do think, you know, there are some very kind of basic structures of arguments that we see. And the tools of kind of classical rhetoric that I do think work, you know, for everything. So when I say like the tools of classical rhetoric and logos, ethos, and pathos, kind of relying on facts, relying on credibility, relying on an emotional appeal, those basic tools I think work across everything, are necessary across everything. And then I also think, and you know, you do see this both in politics and in the private sector, certainly with consumer facing. Businesses, but you know, this an attempt to kind of connect with people as people, and to remind people not just of sort of the features of your product, but the benefits of your product. You know, so if you're selling cars, you're not. I mean, you may be very proud of the sophisticated engine that you've built, or the you know the incredible kind of technology that went into the shatterproof glass, but for the you know, the family you're trying to sell the car to, what really matters is that it's going to keep their kids safe. You know, that if this car, you know, is in an accident, right, that everybody's going to survive, that, you know, that this car gets great gas mileage and won't bust your budget when you're driving to Florida for spring break, you know, like all it's right. It's, you're presenting it in a different way. And I think it's a lot of the same principles.
Podcast listeners, Al here. I'm going to stop the podcast at this point. There are a lot of tips and tricks that Venka is going to get to in the next podcast, part two. So stay tuned. It's going to be great. See you.